transformative, right? That it reframes your lived experiences to a way of understanding and knowing that empowers you and honors you and embraces your brilliance and all that you bring to us. And so that's what I have to say about that.
Beautiful. Well, I'll tell you one thing. I wish I had a chance to take a course with you when I was going to college. You're the kind of professor I'd want to have. But I have to tell you and let people know, we've been speaking with Professor Lorena Gonzalez. She's got a busy evening. They're showing they're screening American Homeboy. That's a documentary film highlighting elements of Mexican-American culture. It's going to screen here in the Bay Area where we broadcast from at Contra Costa College's Knox Center Theater. You can check that out. There must be a website connection. People can check it out. Yes?
Professor? Yes, you can. If you go to AmericanHomeboy.com, it'll give you all the information about the film, the training, connecting with the director, and for people in the Bay Area, Brandon is going to be back. He's the director, and American Homeboy is going to be screened April 26th at 5 p.m. at Skyline College in San Bruno. And so you could look up the RIDE conference at Skyline College, and again, April 26th at 5 p.m. it will be screened there again. And those are the two dates in the Bay Area.
Beautiful.
And I have we're gonna to go.
Yes. Go. Bye bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
And here's what we're going to do. We're going to play a trailer. Yes. Yes. And we're going to play a trailer right now. Listen to this. You want to hear a little bit more about American Homeboy? Check this out.
It don't make no difference what you wear in this country. There's people behind these clothes that have good heart.
Again, this was part of what segregation did, is if you were racialized, or even if you were poor, you could only live there.
Anytime we're trying to sort of understand Mexican-American history and culture, it's very complicated.
You were proud of your Spanish last name. You know, we used to get them in Old English.
Pants were perfectly creased.
Dark lipstick, the Sharpie eyebrows.
The Zoot Suit was all part of jazz culture.
Not cholo. Cholo.
Back in the day, if you hit the switch in front of a cop, it's over.
Pachucos were rounded up, beaten down.
If you don't know that you're Chicano, then you're not.
When they first started those gang injunctions, I said, no, that's not good.
Something hit me too, the grenade. But it hit me right here in the eye, bullseye.
When I worked in East LA, I wound up in the gang unit.
We didn't call ourselves gang members. We were social clubs.
There's a difference between a guy who's commuting to work and a car that's cruising and looks like a shark.
We're talking about a whole new culture. We had our own slang. The calor was different.
Chicanas and Mexican-American women were sort of using American culture.
It wasn't just the way they dressed. It's the way they walked.
They got beat up solely because they refused to take their clothing off. Then they were beat up, and then the clothing was taken off. Clothing was either ripped up and burned or blown.
Streets ain't woke. You're gonna get shot and killed.
We're always different. We're going to be different. This is just the way around.
That's part of us being Chicanos, because that's what we went through.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and I think joining us now is Miguel Gavila Molina and Francisco Herrera. Welcome to Flashpoints, folks. Are you there?
Yep. Aquí up right here. Thank you. Aquí estamos.
That's Francisco and Gavila.
Mm-hmm. We're ready for the countdown, Dennis.
And your response to the description of Pachuco and Cholo, do you think the professor had it right?
Well, that's the roots of our cultura. Back in the 50s, they called us Spanish Americans. You know, during the 60s into the 70s,
you know, we were considered Hispanics or Mexican Americans or other. But I think one of the things that really comes across is, you know, this cultural clash, you know, between, you know, Mexican identity, indigenous identity, and colonial Euro-American identity, you know, sprouts this, you know, the whole Pachuco to me was a statement of defiance. You know, the clothes, the walk, the talk, the hair, everything was a statement of defiance. You're not going to grind us up and mix us into a melting pot and come out with something. This is who we are. We're creating our own image. We're creating our own identity between two worlds. You know, that's what I gather, you know, from that whole beginning of Pachuco and then into the 70s, 80s, 90s, the whole Cholo phenomenon. It's a continuation of that. And as Professor Lorena Gonzalez was saying, you know, the whole this whole, you know, criminalization of cruising, of low riding, of cholos, of pachucos, was a way of dominance of the major mainstream society. You know, you either this or you can't be anything, and if you're not this, you don't belong. Well, we've been here. We're indigenous. We have ancestral roots. Would you agree, Francisco?
Most definitely, I agree on that. And not just that, but we didn't cross the border. That border crossed us. And in fact, I think that border double crossed us because you had a treacherous betrayal government in Mexico City, and you had an invasion force that even Abraham Lincoln, when he was a senator, said, "Show me one drop of one drop of U.S. blood that's been shed by any Mexican. I am completely against." And he was the Barbara Lee at that time. He was the sole vote against the invasion of Mexico by the Marines. And so it's a big double cross, and people here maintain their identity in many different ways. And the Pachuco was an evolution of one of those expressions, which had to do with dignity, with standing up. It had to do with dress your best, and really kind of a combination, I think, of the black and brown unity, and when one culture was riffing off of the other and vice versa. You know, you had Nat King Cole singing Mexican songs in English, and Los Panchos, a famous Mexican trio, first triumphed in New York before they became famous and successful in Mexico. So you had this whole fusion of cultures going on, and indigenous people taking on the German band and turning it into the banda Sinaloa. And so you had a whole fusion of relationships happening that were peaceful, really, very much so in terms of those relationships.
So maybe we can bridge. Tomorrow, the state, the world, the country, we're going to be celebrating, among other things, Cesar Chavez. I'm going to have the privilege to be with you guys here in the Bay Area, in the Mission District, which is historically sort of a home for indigenous Latino folks. People have been fighting to preserve the mission of San Francisco and against gentrification. And maybe Francisco and then Gabilondo, what's the bridge between what we've been talking about, you know, and moving towards Aslan, and how does Cesar Chavez enter into this history?
Well, I think, Dennis and Francisco, that Cesar, you know, he himself identified himself as a Chicano, Mexican-American, as a Chicano, Dolores Huerta as a Chicana. And I think that was a continuation of what happened in the 50s with the Zoot Suit and the riots and then the affirmation of identity. And you know, when Cesar Chavez and Dolores launched you know, the first pilgrimage back in 1966 to bring attention to the plight of farm workers across the country and the world. You know, lowriders were there. You know, the Brown Berets, you know, were there. And also the American Indian movement were there. And I think that today what we see is, you know, an evolution. I know that the last pilgrimage we took back in 2022, which I participated in, and some of the members of La Onda crew, you know, we saw everywhere we went, there was lowriders. You know, lowriders coming out with food, with supplies, with water, with ice, with bandages, you know, with medicine to treat our feet and so forth. And it was powerful to see that town after town after town, day after day, you know, whichever place we crossed, they would come out. So that whole culture is intertwined. And the Brown Berets also provided security up and down the valley for the walkers, you know, during the pilgrimage to Eleno de Sacramento. So I think tomorrow it's a big day in the city. I think it's, I'm not sure if it's a 26th annual, but it's an annual Cesar Chavez parade and festival. And in these times, you know, right now, we need people like Cesar. You know, he was a man of peace. He preached nonviolence. He prayed, he meditated, he was a vegetarian. So there's a lot of things that, you know, are really clear today. And if he was alive today, we both know, we all three of us know, you know, what he would say about the conflict in the Middle East. Would you agree, Francisco?
Yeah, that's amazing. I was talking with Dennis earlier and telling him that we've been talking, and that's exactly my reflection about tomorrow. And Cesar Chavez, because, you know, we could do a lot of hoopla and stuff, but right now we're facing where just yesterday the 141st journalist was murdered in Palestine. What is it, 12,000 children now? About 36,000 that you can actually count. So we don't know how many people are under the rubble. And so I think the same like with Gavilan, we have to elevate the role that Cesar Chavez would be playing right now, which would be a call for ceasefire, a call for peace, a call for working people to really stand up and make their voice heard, that war is not the answer. Well, in fact, I don't see war happening in Palestine. I see a massacre and genocide. You know, war, you have to have two fighting groups, and right here we have one group that's obliterating the other with violence. And so I think for me the way to celebrate Cesar Chavez is really to double up on our efforts to call for the government of the United States to stop supporting Israel and cease fire.
Yeah, I think the whole world agrees with that. If I may just add,
Cesar was born in San Luis, in Arizona, in the very border, only 45 minutes from where I was born. And that border is at war. We've got 30 people being murdered in Mexico every day and not every night. And so the ceasefire is really, it has to be around the globe where the U.S. is involved. In Mexico, with the famous U.S. drug war, that's the same thing Nixon did during the Vietnam War and in Palestine. It's this, but as well throughout the world, what we have now, 800 military bases around the world. So yeah, it's got to be a call.
It's amazing. Yes, that's beautiful. And Miguel, if people want to gather and celebrate tomorrow, what's the best way for them and people here, I guess, in the Bay Area, unless you want to fly in from Houston? But if people in the Bay Area want to get involved, I know it's happening in the mission. How do they find the celebration, the march?
Well, I know ourselves, we will be located at Folsom and 24th Street to do recordings and to do coverage of the parade. Francisco, do you have more details on that?
As I understand it, it will come up 54th Street, as traditionally has happened, and will end at 24th and Folsom. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm sure people just Google around.
On the safe side, people can take the BART to 24th and Mission, and there'll be people giving instructions all over the place.
Beautiful. That's exactly what I'm going to do. When you see Mr. Magoo stumbling looking for directions, that's me. Thank you both. I love you both very much. Take care.
All right.
See you tomorrow. See you mañana. What time tomorrow, by the way? What time?
I believe it starts around 9 o'clock.
Okay. Get there early. Have a lot of fun. It's wonderful to be in the Mission. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break when we come back to the ongoing genocide, you know where. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, the genocide continues and the attack on journalists continue. I don't know if it's 140 or 141, but I'll tell you this. Three more journalists have been injured, one seriously, in an Israeli attack at the Nusrat refugee camp in central Gaza that authorities say is besieged at this point. The targeted journalist, who was totally marked as a journalist in a vehicle that was marked in a journalist, Sami Shadia, suffered the worst wound and lost a leg in this attack. And, you know, the killing fields continue. Joining us to talk about this is somebody who I have a great deal of respect for, who was an anti-war warrior for a long time, and is very active in his resistance of war, and in this case, in this genocide. His name is David Swanson. David Swanson is an author, activist, journalist. He's a radio host. He's the director of World Beyond War. He writes books like War is a Lie. Welcome back to Flashpoints, David Swanson.
Hi, Dennis. Thanks.
It's good to have you with us. Well, you did a piece in late November, and you called it 20 Things You're Not Supposed to Know About the War on Gaza. And number one starts, the ideal war for the U.S. government and the weapons dealers that have such control over it is a war fought with U.S. weapons by non-U.S. fighters. The war in Ukraine, the Saudi war on Yemen, the current war in Gaza, these risk few U.S. lives directly but enrich U.S. oligarchs substantially. Well, I'm just thinking, I remembered this essay as I learned that on the day that the chef and his operation were slaughtered was the same day that the United States was making good on a weapon shipment of, I think it was 1,800 2,000-pound bunker busters and 50 fighter jets. I don't know how they're going to be used for the Gaza Strip, because they fly over it so quickly. I think they might be for somewhere else in this region. And everybody's sort of thinking about what's next, Rondavid, in terms of Iran. So where are we now? Before we get into your wonderful sign campaign, where do you see the war now? What are your concerns? What are your worries? Are you ready for the next? Everybody's talking about Iran. The United States swears its alliance with Israel if Iran strikes back after it's the attack that Israel carried out on its consulate in Syria. Talking fast, but talk to me.
Yeah, well, that's a hugely dangerous escalation, as well as a much sought after and used and abused for decades excuse for the weapons to Israel, so that at some point people in Washington, including President Biden, could talk about wanting no weapons to be used for murdering people in Gaza, but the desperate, urgent, moral need for more weapons to fight Iran. And of course, there's the danger of bringing in a dozen additional countries into a spreading war. But the weapons flow thus far has been explicitly for the purpose of the war on Gaza. You know, there's been secrecy, there's been announcements, but when questioned, that's been the purpose. You know, either Biden and much of the U.S. Congress and many people in Washington, D.C. have just so normalized the shipping of weapons to wars that they don't think it can be questioned, and they can convince themselves that they are sincerely pleading with Israel to stop murdering people while eagerly shipping huge, giant piles of weapons to Israel. Or, and maybe it's both, or they think we are absolute idiots. They just believe we have, you know, not a brain cell among us, and we're willing to swallow the disgusting stupidity that they are somehow trying to stop the mass murder while providing the weapons for it.
What do you think about the entrance into the war, the use of artificial intelligence, if you can call it that, and the targeting, the explanation that so many people are dying because of this new mechanized war? How do you put this into this piece into the puzzle? It's quite extraordinary.
I miss it. I don't get it. I don't know what people are so upset about. I completely understand the horror and fear of machines being capable of killing humans without any human control. We don't need that additional problem on top of all the problems we've got. But countries have been bombing each other and killing people by the tens and hundreds of thousands for many years now, and doing it with and without computers being involved in any way or at various degrees. And I just don't think it's any more or less evil, no matter, you know, what role in the targeting is played by what advanced computer technology. You're murdering people. I just don't care how it's done. I care whether it's done. It needs to be stopped.
I know, but my only point, David, is that it, according to all the folks who I depend on, the death toll is way higher, given the way in which this war was prosecuted and the way in which they're working in AI into the flow. But you're right, the death machine and the you know, the export of weapons is up 60% this year. I mean, I don't even know what these figures mean, but anyway, let me remind people that we're speaking with David Swanson. David Swanson is a founder of World Beyond War. He writes many books. You all are engaged in what I think is a very cool and interesting way of resisting the genocide. You're doing signs in Washington, D.C., so when you come off the bus, instead of a soap sud commercial on the sign, you see what?
you see the words, stop sending weapons to Israel. We're putting these 7-foot-high by 3-foot-wide mini billboards on the bus stops in downtown D.C. around the White House and Capitol and downtown area, with plans to, you know, do walking tours and hand out flyers at these bus stops and make some videos, see what people think, and try to get the word from one more angle. Into the minds of some of the people who have the ability to do anything about this. We know the powerful people are not on buses, they're in SUVs, but they see these signs on the streets in Washington, D.C., and, you know, every little bit helps.
The people who rent these signs, wouldn't they prefer to just stay out of the political realm and rent them to the bubblegum commercials or theater shows or whatever? Is there a struggle to get them to put up these kinds of messages?
Oh, for sure. I mean, months ago, years ago, we could not have put this on any bus stop or billboard in Washington, D.C., and most of the billboard and large ad companies and the entire metro train system, the ads in the subway stations and on the metro buses, will not allow anything that they call political or advocacy, which means you're not selling toasters or automobiles or aircraft carriers. Who buys those? Congress. How is that not advocacy? I don't know. But now I think because of pressure from us and from the ACLU and from a number of organizations, and maybe the sheer greed that they've figured out that they can charge a lot more money for it, some of the companies, including Clear Channel, have started accepting these sorts of ads and charging a fortune for them. And they won't even tell us how much lower the rate would be if we were selling toasters. But it's worth it. It's worth it to people who donate money to World Beyond War precisely to put up billboards and big ads, because it can have an impact. It can create discussions. It can spread in other media beyond just the billboards themselves. But yeah, you call these people up and they try to talk you out of it. It's remarkable.
Before we let you go, David, what is your concern now? Are you now very worried about the expanding regional war? Everybody's saying Iran's going to strike back. What are your thoughts? What's your best shot on where we're going?
Well, you know, they've been lying about Iran for decades, and chances are they're lying now, and I certainly hope they're lying now, but it's entirely possible that they poke Iran enough times that Iran hits back, and that then everything is blamed on Iran, and instead of October 7th, all we ever hear about until the nuclear clouds is, you know, April 28th or whatever it might be. It's a real danger, and there needs to be immediate serious action to avert that. And the top move that needs to be made is for the United States to stop fueling the war. What does Iran want? It wants the United States and Israel to stop mass murdering people in Gaza with 2,000-pound bombs, each of which takes out a whole block and leaves a 40-foot crater, whether a computer targets it or not. You know, this is what's got to be stopped. Everybody needs to tell everybody they can and every government official they can get at to stop sending the weapons.
Yeah. And if people want to know more about the work that you do, David Swanson, and about World Beyond War, what's the best way to stay in contact? Maybe they want to participate, lock arms with your work?
I guess the easiest thing is worldbeyondwar.org, the website where you can find our billboard campaign. You can donate to the billboard campaign, help us put out up more. You can find local chapters and affiliates, organizations, and events in your area. You can learn about everything and that we're doing and all of our friends are doing at worldbeyondwar.org.
Are you going to pay your taxes this year?
Unfortunately, I am. I admire encourage all of my friends who are not, but it's not actually a simple matter when you have numerous jobs and families, members, and responsibilities. But I'm not going to do it happily, and I'm not going to do it without protest. And I'm not going to do it without demanding that the money be moved out of militarism and into decent things.
All right. Well, happy tax day to you. We're going to be talking about that with Code Pink. That's why I bring it up. We appreciate your time, David. Stay safe.
Yeah, thanks very much, Dennis. Keep it up.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Short break, and we're back. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. By the way, I mentioned that the attacks, Israeli attacks on journalists continued. And the journalist who was, there were three journalists that got hit again. They were totally marked in the Nusrat refugee camp. Among them, Sami Shehada, journalist with Turkish broadcasting TRT, had to have his foot amputated after being attacked along with these other journalists of the Israelis. And again, they were perfectly marked there. And obviously, it seems like the Israelis use, oh, that's a journalist, and we know for sure, so let's kill him. I think it's either 140 or 141. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that it's Sami Shehada who lost a leg trying to tell you the truth and get you alternative information, because everything else that you watch on these U.S. corporate networks comes through Israeli censors or not at all. Remember that. Joining us is Cynthia Papermaster. She works with Code Pink San Francisco. She's been quite active trying to resist this genocide. And Code Pink has got some plans for a tax day coming up at the beginning of next week. Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much, Dennis. I'm so honored to be following David Swanson, whose work I have supported for many years. And I have in my living room a giant facsimile of that billboard he was talking about, and it says 3% of U.S. military spending could end starvation on Earth. And these were billboards that were up in the Bay Area for a month or two. So we're going to bring this billboard with us to our event on Monday, and I'll just say where it is and when. We meet up at the UN Plaza, which is in Civic Center of San Francisco, Market and Hyde, and then we gather there for about a half hour, and then we get in formation for a parade, and the parade is going to the Internal Revenue Service just a couple blocks away at 450 Golden Gate Avenue. So, and you're invited, Dennis, and everyone's invited. Everyone who is what I call an irate taxpayer, I think that's most of us, for the reasons that David was talking about. We don't want to pay for war and genocide with our tax dollars. We would prefer to use that money for peace and for helping people and human needs and education, healthcare, clean energy, affordable housing, and the list goes on and on. So please join us, everyone.
And this is a tax protest on Tax Day?
Oh, yeah. It's part of a nationwide economic blockade that's happening on Monday all over the world, and especially in the United States. There's something in Oakland in the morning. I'm not at liberty to say exactly what that is, but people can find out about it, I think. and our event was at noon on Monday, and we are saying, gathering together, and we're saying no taxes for war and genocide, and we have a pledge. We'll explain that on Monday to people, and we'll also put the word out about this. If you don't want to pay your taxes, there's ways to not do that. I'm not going to pay taxes this year, and I have no fear about that. It's more important to me to not support a genocide than it is any threat of penalty or risk or fine or anything like that from the IRS. But the IRS doesn't always go after people who don't pay their taxes, and I'm going to be in that group. I'm going to be in the group that feels good because I'm not paying for this genocide.
Amazing. So you're urging people to withhold their taxes?
Well,
it's light of the fact that... Go on.
Oh, well, it's up to them whether they want to pay their taxes or not, but we have a pledge that says that they don't want to. I know that sounds a little strange, but it's like the pledge you make to KPFA. I make a pledge every time there's a pledge drive, and I always honor it.
Okay, no pitching okay. Here on the today, so
okay.
We don't do
okay.
That.
I always honor it, though, but nobody comes knocking on my door if I don't. Anyway, we encourage people not to pay their taxes if they don't want to. And there's ways to do that, and we'll be distributing that information on Monday at our tax teach-in up at the IRS at 450 Golden Gate. And we'll be up there around noon. Our parade is at 12:30, leaving from UN Plaza in the Civic Center.
Perfect. Let me ask you, you have been doggedly trying to hold Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, former, accountable for her stand in support of Israel. She has, you did some serious protesting, you did a hunger fast, you're arrested, you're facing charges for your resistance, but she does appear to have changed her mind a little bit. And I want to bring this back up because everybody thinks that, you know, you go out, you act, and nothing ever changes. But sometimes it does. Sometimes you don't see it. Sometimes it's slow, not as fast as you want. But you have been incredibly effective because you've been focused and because you believe in so much what you're doing. So everybody can believe with you. But do you feel at least a little bit gratified that she now has to turn in your direction in terms of thinking about this war as genocide? Oh. Although she didn't say genocide.
No, she didn't say genocide. And thank you, Dennis, for acknowledging my work. I'm hesitant to take credit because I think it's more about her sadness over her friend, the chef of the World Central Kitchen chef, whose people got murdered, seven of those aid workers got murdered, and I think that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back, if you want to put it that way. But I think we contributed. I think all of our work, bird-dogging Nancy Pelosi in Washington, D.C., Code Pink there, Medea Benjamin, and all the folks there, And then our work here in San Francisco, where we've been to her house repeatedly, begging her, imploring her to come out for a ceasefire, to allow aid into Gaza. It may have helped to get her to sign a letter to Biden, but I don't think that's enough. If she keeps voting for weapons, it's certainly not enough. It's just words, and talk is cheap.
And what's next for you in terms of how can people support, find out about what's happening with you, with your case? I want them to know that, how do they do that? Code Pink?
Well, codepink.org. They can follow there. There's press releases there they can look at. My arraignment is on April 26th at 850 Bryant Street, Department 10. And I don't know if I get to plead that day, but I will plead not guilty. And I don't know if I can say much about the case, but I have a very good lawyer.
Good. Well, we don't want you to get you in trouble. Glad you have a good lawyer. And many of us have been inspired by the stand that you've been taking, and hundreds, thousands of folks all over the Bay Area. I know you were at law school party, shall we say, the other night.
Oh, yeah. I was yelling shame because the law school dean's wife grabbed a microphone away from a nice law school student who, Palestinian, who was just greeting people for Ramadan, and it was shameful. I was yelling shame, shame outside their house the other night, last night.
And why was that important for you to be there? That was a pretty amazing a situation where you have the dean of the UC Berkeley Law School, who has some respectable liberal credentials. He was a lawyer on the Rachel Corrie case on the appeal. Apparently, and you're saying that you saw, what exactly did you see?
Well, I saw video, and many people have seen it. I believe you have. There were some law school students invited to Dean Chemerinsky's house to celebrate their graduation or the end of the school year. And there was a Palestinian student. Yeah, law students. And a Palestinian student was speaking and greeting people for Ramadan. And Chemerinsky's wife came over and grabbed the microphone away from her and actually kind of assaulted her. And Chemerinsky, instead of intervening and saying, you know, let her speak, just let her finish, he joined in and he said, "You, it's my house, you have to go, you have to leave." It was shameful.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there for now, but we're not going to, we're going to keep following that story. Thank you, Cynthia Papermaster, Code Pink. We appreciate all the great work. We got to get out of here. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934